We don't realize this oftentimes, but for girls, it's hitting at 9 years old. And for boys, this is 10 years old. But they're getting adult doses of hormones dumped in their little bodies. And that is jarring for them. And so you think they're changing physically, emotionally, socially, cognitively, and sexually. Now, they're all changing in those five ways, in life-altering ways, but it's quite a mismatch. So some kids are developing physically, but they're kind of delayed socially, or vice versa.
Das ist mal ehrlich, der Podcast.
Why is today's podcast in English for the first time ever? Well, because I had the great honor to speak to one of Australia's top experts on tweens and teenagers, but more about her in a second. If you would rather read this podcast in German, no problem. We will have a separate interview translated into German and you will find it in the show notes. But now let me get excited about my guest, Michelle Mitchell. I've been wanting to talk to her forever. But as she has been to every big TV show and podcast there is in Australia, my hopes to have her as a guest were not too high, to be honest with you. But here we are. Michelle is an Australian educator, speaker, and best-selling author of books like Tweens, Everyday Resilience, and The Small Guides to Puberty, which I personally love, but unfortunately are not available in Switzerland yet. After years of teaching, Michelle started the Youth Excel charity. And now she spends her time helping parents like us and schools how to understand and guide tweens and teenagers with practical and down-to-earth advice. Oh, and she's also one of the nicest people I've ever met. So I hope you enjoy this podcast.
How are you today?
Oh, I'm great. The sun is shining here, as you know. Yes. We can't go too far wrong.
No, it's amazing. I'm so excited to talk to you because I've actually been wanting to speak to you for a very long time, but I thought, you know, this might not happen because I know how busy you are and there's so many things that you do. And I'm thinking this must be also maybe be a little bit of a new experience for you being, you know, such a renowned expert around Australia. Now you're talking to a Swiss person and maybe not so many people know you yet in Switzerland. So maybe would you give me a little short, in a nutshell, compilation of like how you got there, where you are?
Oh, yes. I began my career as a teacher. 4 years in, I just knew I wanted to be in the space of well-being. And education was so different back there. There was much more of a focus on, I guess, the fundamentals of reading and writing, and well-being wasn't embedded in the curriculum like it is now. So I left classroom teaching. I founded a charity, and for 25 years, I just invested into life skills programs. I was tailor-making one-on-one life skills programs with kids in a mentoring format and doing group programs for kids. And I founded a psychology clinic in that journey as well, which was really innovative. It was a multidisciplinary clinic as well. So we had social workers, we had, you know, the medical as well as youth workers and mentors working and school holiday programs. It was such a dynamic place. And yeah, that was probably the highlight of my career, but it led me to more speaking and writing and being able to transfer my work to parents in this way. And I love what I'm doing now. I feel like I get to really speak into parents' homes and hearts.
The fact that, you know, I even knew about you or started reading your book is that a friend of mine gave me your book about tweens. And I don't think I even knew the term before I read the book. So I don't even know. Like, did you invent the term, or was it there before?
It's definitely, I did not invent the term, but I do get a lot of people say to me, like, is my kid a tween? And sometimes I think a tween is a 12-year-old, like just on the cusp of the teenage years, or just on the cusp of going to high school. But tweens are particularly 9 to 12-year-olds, so it embodies that stage of development that's not a child and that's not a teenager. And it's an overlooked stage of development that we haven't really kind of itemized and picked out and really talked about what's happening in their brain, because it's a really unique stage of development. And all the research now is showing that that age in this day and age is where kids are most at risk and where they need us to intervene the most. And I'm so passionate about it, probably because I've worked a lot with teenagers and I see this 9 to 12 year old bracket is the place where we can make the most difference.
Mm-hmm. That's what I would like to talk to you about within the next hour, is like, why is this window from 9 to 12 so important and how can we support our children? You actually did a study in 2020 with tweens and with their parents. And you found out that even like a quarter of the tweens did not look forward to adolescence. They were actually kind of scared of it.
Yeah. They're overwhelmed. And I think there's a few reasons for this. I think they were finding the stage they were in at that time already so difficult. And they were anticipating that the years ahead were going to increase in severity. And that sometimes because of what they were seeing projected on the media, that, you know, those teenage years in high school, there was a lot of bullying and so much was going to go wrong in the adolescent years. Sometimes parents were saying to them, please don't grow up or don't become a difficult teenager. And they were like, what's a difficult teenager? I don't even know what that means, but I promise I won't be like that, because they're so wanting to please their parents at this age as well. So I think there was all this fear and angst about not becoming that type of teenager that was going to, number one, give their parents grief, and number one, going to make them feel any worse than they were currently feeling, because they were feeling so overwhelmed already.
The parents or the kids?
The kids themselves.
The kids themselves.
And we've got to realize that when puberty starts hitting, and we don't realize this oftentimes, but for girls it's hitting at 9 years old, and for boys this is 10 years old, but they're getting adult doses of hormones dumped in their little bodies, and that is jarring for them. And so you think they're changing physically, emotionally, socially, cognitively, and sexually. Now, they're all changing in those five ways, in life-altering ways, but it's quite a mismatch. So some kids are developing physically, but they're kind of delayed socially, or vice versa. So they can't compare themselves to any of their peers. They feel so out of sync with everything and everyone. And they are on this roller coaster ride that's unique to them. And they sort of wake up every day going, what's normal? Is this normal? I'm feeling a little bit different. And every kid feels like they're going through it in a way that's almost unexplainable, but so unique to them. And for some of our kids, it's a little speed bump, but other kids, they feel like they hit, you know, these experiences like a massive speed bump, and that nobody understands them, and they don't yet have the language even to articulate it. And some parents have said to me, Michelle, 11, it was the hardest year. I've got a 15-year-old now, but 11 was our hardest year. At 15, she's got the language to articulate what's going on a lot better, and she's got more skills for coping. But 11, it was just all emotion, and she didn't know what was going on, and she was clinging to me for dear life, and I didn't even know how to help her.
Do we as parents, can we notice when like that hormone dump is happening? Are there signs that we can look out for?
It's such a great question, Andrea. For me, I want to be really clear for parents to make sure that they're not interpreting kids' maybe big behavior, or sometimes, difficult behavior, as just them going through some naughty stage, or they're being a difficult kid, when there's so much going on underneath the surface that we're not recognizing as developmental. Most of our kids' behavior is driven by these developmental changes, and we call them in research under the bonnet changes, and it's a lot bigger than we realize. It's really easy to look at a teenager and go, gosh, they're growing and I'm seeing pubic hair, or I'm seeing their underarm hair. I'm not seeing pubic hair. Sorry, let me rewind that. I'm seeing their underarm hair and I can smell them coming. So it's really easy to say, I know why they're in a bad mood. You know what I mean? Like it's you attribute it mentally, but it's almost like we've got to take that same lens and look at our 9-year-old and going, there's a lot happening behind the surface. and the climb for them between 9 and 12 is a lot bigger than we're anticipating. And they're carrying a lot more on our shoulders than we think they are.
As for example, I read also that the menstrual cycle is also actually the last event of this whole development, which is so interesting because, you know, for us up to this point, it was like, oh, this is when it starts.
Yeah. And that's probably, you've articulated that maybe better than I just did, but we're looking for these outward signs. And mums often say to me, oh, I think she might be getting ready to get her period. Or I think she's, you know, just those breasts are just starting to bud. But what we don't realize, it can be 2 years before where they're getting these surges of hormones, where they are internally changing. And when I talk to kids in schools around puberty, I'm saying, well, most of the changes are happening internally and you're not seeing those changes, but there's changes going on behind the scenes that you don't even account for. And, you know, our little boys, exactly the same. And my son is a prime example of my eldest is one, a prime example of one of those kids where, you know, these changes hit him hard and heavy. He grew a foot in under a year and he went from size 8 men's shoes to size 12 men's shoes, pushing size 13 men's shoes. And it was one hell of a year. But you'll notice in my book, in the first chapter, he allowed me to put his story in because he said, "Mum, I woke up one day and I wondered what had happened to you." And I think what we don't do is flip the experience. And if we're saying to ourselves, what's happened to my little girl? You know, what's happened to my kid? They're behaving so badly. They're so moody all the time. They're so this, they're so that. We've actually got to flip the experience and realize they didn't ask for this. You know, childhood's getting taken from them inch by inch. And they actually didn't ask for this experience either. And they're adjusting just as much as we are.
Mm-hmm. And at the same time, they are also, I think, learning how to see different perspectives. That's the time span where they actually also kind of get to understand where we come from.
You have read my book. This is like the big one to me. Yeah, I love you. This is to me the biggest thing that I see. You know, parents will say, I came in the house after work and they're crying on their bedroom floor because someone looked at them the wrong way. And I go, okay, let me take you through what's happening cognitively, because they're changing in 5 ways and one of those is their cognitive development. They're increasing in their ability to perspective take, which is put themselves for like a better term, the shoes of someone else. In other words, understand that other people think differently than they do. So maybe for the first time in their little lives, they realize that someone actually doesn't like them. You know what I mean? That they're going to be walking through the world and that maybe 1 in 5 people are not going to be their jam and they're not going to be their jam, you know? And that hits them heavy. And it takes them a minute to actually accept that not everyone in the world is going to embrace them the same way that their mum does. And that can be hard for them to come to terms with.
How does it affect them in interaction with us as parents? You know, do they try to, you also, I think they wrote that, you know, they feel guilt about their acting out and they feel bad about being the way they are, even though they can't help it.
Yeah. If anyone's listening and has got a child who's just like had a big meltdown or had a big fight with their sibling and they know that they've inconvenienced you, they know that maybe they've even hurt your feelings and said something that they shouldn't have, and they're all up there with their mood, but then an hour later they come in, I'm so sorry, I shouldn't have acted like that, and maybe they even write you this gorgeous note and they're so remorseful because they care about your opinion of them more than anything else in the world at this age. And they also really, your attachment with them so matters. This is an age where that attachment stretch is happening. And I really come back to Gordon Neufeld's work about those sort of 5 really important things that kids need within their attachment. Proximity is one. Sameness is one, you know, belonging is another one. those things that kids need, we come back to those things in their teenage years and we double down on them, especially when they're feeling that sense of insecurity that they might have hurt us, because they're wanting to feel embraced by us and make sure that even though they're growing up, even though they're having some different explosive behaviors, that we still love them, that they know we love them as children, but will you love me even when I'm changing and growing and still finding myself? And this really plays out with siblings too, Andrea. You really see this very clearly. And or if they make a uncalculated decision that's really out of character for them, they might have done something really silly to want to fit in with their peers, because all of a sudden they've got this bigger drive to fit in with their peers, but then they have this big remorse. And I say to parents, you know, when they're 15, they may not be running back for your approval the same way they do when they're 10 and 11. So embrace them now and show them what repair looks like and double down on that love for them.
Can you make an example for sameness? And what was the other one you said before, belonging?
Yeah, we can go through these because these are really, really important. Let's go through these. We can go through all of them. Proximity is a really important one. Kids often start to get a little bit more school refusal in these years. They may have anxiety when it comes to sleepovers. They may not want to leave and go to grandma's house in the same way and stay over. And you go, what's happening with my kid? What's the anxiety around this? It's that attachment stretch. They're developing so quickly that they're looking for stable ground. And we've got to really double down on our attachment with them. So they're wanting to hang around us a lot more. They're wanting to hover. Parents just get exhausted by it. But it's so normal. So okay. If they do, parents are like, they don't leave me alone. Like I turn around and they're like this little thing following me everywhere, you know. So that's normal. So just really embrace them. If they need to sleep with you at night, parents tell me this all the time. I'm like, what's the big deal, you know? Put a little mattress next to them. If they need that level of security, it's an attachment stretch so they can feel safe going into the world again. Sameness. If you listen to boys, grade 5 in the classroom, oh, my dad can lift 120 kilos. I'm strong like him. You know, like it's this brag session that happens, but also wanting to see themselves in their parents. Now, when you're a teenager, when you've got teenagers, the number one mistake you make is telling a teenager that you were just like them when you were 14, because they want to be anything but you.
Okay.
Right? But when you've got a, yeah, when you've got a 10, 11, 12-year-old, you just want to, you and I, yeah, let's get matching outfits, matching UGG boots that we can sit and watch a movie together because we love the same movies, and what kind of popcorn do we love? That's the thing they love. Belonging and loyalty. I'm on your team, kid, and whatever you tell me stays between you and me. And this is where you need to start building that sense of, yeah, no, I'm not going to go and talk to Auntie and Grandma and your friend's mum. You exclusively start to parent your own child because they need to know you're on their team. And they start to get this heightened sense of insecurity if you're talking about them anywhere else. And the fourth one is that they matter and they're really significant and they want to cartwheel in front of you and they want to show you how high they can jump on that trampoline and they want you to come to every ballet thing they're doing and their every soccer game and take 100 photos of them and that they're the most important child in the whole world. But this is all about attachment, Andrea. This is important stuff.
So when I'm taking from this is that maybe as a parent, you know, I would expect my kids when they're growing up, like with every year, to become a little bit more independent. But actually what's happening at this age is they might take a step back because they need us more. And I don't have to be surprised by it.
Oh, I love that. And forewarned is forearmed. Like sometimes parents are going, like, have they got an anxiety problem? Is this a mental health issue? Is a absolutely not. Like this is developmentally so normal. And if we feed what they need, a lot of these things are very manageable in their development. I think we're pushing them to the next stage too quickly these days. And I think that's why we're seeing depressive symptoms and when we're seeing anxiety. And the reports are showing, particularly in our girls, and particularly in this area of comparison, when their brains start to be able to perspective take, we're not to say to them that that's wrong or bad or you just do you. They're actually using an area of their brain that they need to be using, but we need to help them use it in a helpful way, not in an unhelpful way. And so we're asking them, what do you believe about yourself? And we're helping them get their own moral compass for life and undergird them with this sense of security at home.
Mm-hmm. I wrote down, it's not about if they compare themselves, but how.
I love that.
And how do we teach them? How do we teach them to make that? How do we teach them to do that? Like, how do we talk to our kids about comparison and about the others versus them?
Oh, I love. I do not want my kids to waltz around this world having an inflated high self-esteem. I want them to have a realistic gauge of themselves and recognize that any gift that they have is for the service of other people. I want my kids to actually be able to legitimately look around a room and know what they have to offer and when to defer to other people. And that's got nothing to do with their worth as a human being. They all stand on equal level playing ground, and that means they can walk into any room with their head held high. But their talents and their abilities are going to differ compared to other people. And that doesn't mean they can't grow and develop their talents and their abilities depending on their goals and depending on their drive and depending on what they want out of life. But their worth is not determined by what other people think of them, or other people can take it away and give it in an instant. And that's why we have kids walking around high school whose mood fluctuates from day to day and second to second, because they're putting their self-esteem in the hands of what other people think about them.
Mm-hmm. But where do I get in? Like, what's my in on this? How do I have this conversation? Or I'm guessing it's probably like a drip conversation that happens over time, but how do I talk to my kids about this? Because I feel like, especially, I have an 11-year-old too. She turned 11 yesterday, and she really struggles to see, you know, what she's about and like the things what she's good at. And sometimes when I tell her, she doesn't even believe me, because she tells me, well, you're my mom, you have to say that.
Absolutely. That's a beautiful line. And you say, I'm your mom and I will always see the best in you. But what's more important than what I see is what you see. So what I want you to do is say, what do you see about yourself? So let's actually put aside what your friends see and what everyone else sees. And I want to know what you see about yourself. And if she has got a underinflated low self-esteem, I don't want you to see that as bad, negative, or a mental health problem, unless it goes on and on and on as in impacting her everyday life, and then we need to maybe talk about that. I want you to see that as a, okay, if that's how she's seeing herself, what would you like to move forward with this? And is that how you want to see yourself? And then we talk about those conversations. Andrew, we could use this as a case study, because kids come home and they say, I'm everything from bad at sport to I'm fat to this to I'm that. And I go, okay, good on you for noticing. What are you noticing? What, that you're shorter than other people? Is it true? In my case, I was the shortest kid in my class. It was true. And I was shorter by, like, you know, a good foot and a half. I am tiny, Andrea. There was no one that could take the pain of that away from me. You know, like, there's some things we can't argue with our kids. You know, maybe she is the worst at soccer, or maybe she doesn't excel at reading. Good on you for noticing, Because when we notice ourselves accurately in the world, we can actually define what we're good at, what we're not good at, and where our gifts lie and where we want to excel. So if I was sitting down with your beautiful girl, Andrea, and we all see them as beautiful, we just want them to see themselves, how wonderful they are, what we'd be saying is, what are you noticing? And it might be too personal for you to answer me this, but like, what is she noticing and what's true, what's not true, and where does she want to grow, you know?
I would like to take a quick break and do some advertising for Mal Ehrlich. Usually at this point, we would have advertisements in German for our supporters and partners. But because this is our first English podcast, I think I need to do some advertising for ourselves. Mal Ehrlich is a platform for equal parenting. We translate into let's be honest in German. And that's what we are. And that's what we stand for, as you probably have found out during this interview. We have this podcast that airs about every 2 weeks. We have an online magazine that publishes new content twice a week, and then we have a huge social media community. As of March this year, we also have a membership where we have 30 experts that will be in a kind of forum with you and give you advice on all the questions that you might have. If you want to support us directly, you can do this in our concept store. Don't need to speak German to do that. And we have a lot of products that we've tested and found good that we sell there. Amongst other things, we will be selling Michelle Mitchell's book, Tweens. We bought it directly from Australia, and this is the only place in Switzerland where you can get it within 1 or 2 days and shipped right to your door. I absolutely recommend it. There's a lot of questions that we talked about in this podcast, but of course there's more. There's the data that comes with everything that Michelle says, and lots of interviews, not only with parents, but also with tweens themselves. Absolutely recommend it, and you can get it in our concept store. And now please enjoy the rest of the podcast.
I think in my specific case, it's hard for her to see anything positive. And then so I am usually the one to point it out for her. And I don't know, like I cannot tell if it resonates. And if she's like, you know, in the back of her head, she's kind of like, oh yeah, that's actually true. Or if she really doesn't want to see it. Yeah.
I love that. As a mum, I'd say this. I'd say, I'm going to tell you how I see it through my eyes. It might be very different than how you see it, honey. And I will always see the best in you, and I will tell you how I see it, but it is only one perspective. What's most important is that we talk about your perspective and how you see it, because you're growing up, so walk one step ahead of her, and you are walking through the world with a perspective now that actually really matters. So every time you open your mouth and every interaction you have, you're carrying the perspective that you're holding, and you are starting to own your perspective as a more grown-up person. Mum doesn't control that perspective. You own that perspective. And I'd like to talk to you about your perspective.
So you feel like these really deep, and also that's like a high level conversation, and that's possible at this age. Like, at what age do we start having these conversations on a level like that?
Beautiful. So they're moving from concrete thinking to complex thinking, and that's what you're pointing out. And I think that is the real challenge with this age, is that we've got a gap sometimes between where they are emotionally and where they're catching up with themselves and what skills they're able to apply to wrap their little heads around maybe some of the thinking that's they're developing, and we're holding them in between. And what you're doing is balancing and holding the fort and doing all the things that you do as a mum, while at the same time going ahead with some autonomy and saying, hey, you're starting to develop some of those skills to be able to manage the way you're thinking about yourself. And that's a really big grown-up skill to have. Mm-hmm. But let's start to open the door to that, because that's complex thinking. Mm-hmm. That's that higher level thinking that she's walking into.
What's the difference between those two thinking processes, and how do they, when do they start and when do they stop?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's not, development's not like on day 22, this starts and this stops. So this is a gradual process. Concrete thinking, in this stage of development, they're going to be very much attached to what mum thinks and family values, and they're going to be very black and white about it. And you can hear in your daughter, she's starting to pull herself away from that and go, that's what you think, mum, but it's not necessarily what I think or my friends think. So she's starting to move away from that real concrete black and white thinking, I better check in with mum first. How does this apply to my family values and what I've been taught? You tell a three-year-old they're wonderful, they're going to say, yes, I agree with you. You know, anything you say, yes, I am. You know, like even seven and, you know, like it's different. You know, you can console a child with your words, but when they get a little bit more into this complex thinking, what they do is they step away from your point of view and they say, mum's point of view is one point of view in the world and I'm going to take it into consideration, but I'm not anchoring all of my perspective on it. And that's what your little girl's doing right now. And I want you to be able to champion that and say, good on you for noticing. I'm giving you one point of view, and maybe your friends have got another point of view, but what matters most is your perspective on all of it. And what we're doing right here is actually digging into how you want to feel about yourself. And only you get to decide that. Not the beauty industry, not your friends. Otherwise, they can give it to you and they can take away. What's your values? And that might take her years to develop, Andrea. Like, this is not any quick bullet fix here.
Mm-hmm. We've been talking about the relationship of the parents and the kids, but I'm wondering at this point, like from your experience, how much do tweens talk to their peers? What do they talk about? Like, how much do they share?
That with no degree of accuracy, their mouth moves constantly.
Okay.
And can we underline with no degree of accuracy? They lie a lot at this age. Okay. A lot. And they don't think they're going to get found out because then they just don't think very, very far, you know. So they do talk a lot about sex when they start to develop sexually. And so even when I'm speaking in schools and do sexual health lessons, one of the things you point out is, hey, I'm not talking to the grade twos today. And it's because their parents have the right to decide when they get this information. And this is a bit of an information update that you get when you're cognitive, we know, when they're cognitively ready for this level of information. And so I talk them through that. And so when you leave this classroom, your responsibility is to be really mature with this level of information that you've got. And they're normally excellent with it. But they have to have the frame up and the explicit instruction of what to do with things. So we're still talking to them in such a black and white way. So when we talk to our kids about sensitive topics, even like family things that are going down at home, like, you know, if something personal is happening within your family, you've actually got to spell it out to a 9 to 12-year-old that this needs to stay within our family. Otherwise, they're likely to go and talk to their neighbor or their teacher. Or it's quite hilarious, actually, what kids tell me about their family. And I'm like, oh, if parents could hear this, they would be dying right now.
Yeah, maybe it's also because they trust you. And I really like the concept that you wrote about lighthouses too. So people who get them, and that doesn't necessarily have to be a parent. Maybe it's even better if it's not a parent. How do we build lighthouses for our kids?
This is so, so important, but so hard at this age because kids are still naive. They're still very trusting. They're still vulnerable. And I still believe that parents need to be big gatekeepers of the lighthouses that are around kids' lives so they don't get taken advantage of, and that parents are still the main gatekeeper of who has access to their child's heart. As kids get into those teenage years and they're able to, I guess, assess risk a little bit better, this naturally takes on a different dynamic. But family, friends, neighbors, school teachers, kids will start to gravitate to adults outside of the home, and it's a natural process of them growing up. And it's really sometimes hits parents hard. It's like, oh, they're talking to other people about things that they would normally talk to me about. Why aren't they coming directly to me? And it is the process of starting to move away and starting to establish broader networks outside of us. But parents, particularly mums, can find it really hard.
Well, I mean, I feel like it could also be an asset, right? It could be, could give them a different perspective again, which I like very much. Mm-hmm. I would like to come back for a minute to self-esteem and body uneasiness, you called it, like all the changes that are happening in the body. And 100% of all the tweens, no, of all the parents said that they think their tweens are experiencing trouble with self-esteem and confidence. So, which is something that we touched on before, and you're saying is a normal development, but still, like, does it have to be that way, or is there anything? How can we support them? How do we talk to them about all the changes that are going on in their body, like inside and outside?
I've never had anybody directly ask me that question. Does it have to be that way? And that's landed with me, Andrea, and I actually am going to say something a little bit bold here, but I actually think that I can't generalize, but I think we need to anticipate that, yes, to some degree, it is going to be that way. And if we come at it from that angle, we're not going to be shocked or surprised when our kids' confidence is a little bit wobbly. In fact, if it wasn't ever wobbly, I would actually be more concerned about a child, because they wouldn't be able to have the experience of what those losses and that perspective bring. That would concern me more. So I love that question for that sake. I do think we need to expect it as being part of normal. When they're young, it's like, look at me, I'm amazing. And my mum tells me I'm amazing, and I'm going to lean into that. And then they get to this stage of like, you know, like, who am I and who loves me? And they really need a lot of reassurance during this age. And that's actually really normal.
Mm-hmm. How does it portray in boys and in girls?
I think what happens with boys is they're developmentally a little bit later, and there's a real complexity that happens here. Any teacher in a classroom will tell you they can have a biologically born male and female sitting side by side, and it can look like they are in two completely different universes. Because not only you've got those five types of development all coming in at different times, so it's not like they all just railroad in at the same time either. So you've got this mismatch happening. So you can have a boy that's physically growing that can be maybe socially or emotionally just a little slower, you know. But you've also got puberty hitting him. So later, so he can be like, I just love my cars still, and I love my Pokemon, and just life's really simple, and I'm not seeing things from anybody else's perspective. I'm still really young and naive, and I love my mum, and I kiss her every night, and we hug, you know. And you've got a girl who's going, when can I get fake eyelashes, and can I have a push-up bra, and I want social media, you know. And they're sitting next to each other, and it's just like, who are these two kids? They're both 10 or they're both 11, and they look completely different. For our boys too, we know the language center is different, comes online differently. Boys also experience close, intimate friendships way later than girls. So intimacy and friendships for boys can be past the chips. You know, that's it. Now, for girls, their friendships can be so complex. And boys are watching on going, They are wild and crazy, and I don't even understand what they're fighting about, you know? So boys can sometimes feel these things. Andrea, they can feel belittled. They can feel lost. They can feel confused. They can feel emotionally overwhelmed. They can feel like they're not keeping up. They can feel like they're not good enough. And they can feel like they don't have the words to articulate what's going on in their world. And when some of their peers are maybe developing a bit quicker than they are, they can really feel like their manhood or who they are is getting like just stripped from them. And I see those boys being quite vulnerable. The smaller kids who haven't found their groove yet, who maybe get that awkward stage where they're not keeping up, I really see them sort of get battered around a bit. And that's where I see, look, extend their social networks outside of school so they have more like that dopamine, oxytocin, those positive neurochemicals, that people map in their life has to be really broad at this stage because school can be rocky for kids.
Do you also see that in a context of, in a bigger context of, you know, what it is to be a man these days and like the boys maybe not really having anything mapped out of where they're, who to look up to?
Yeah, I've just done a webinar with Steve Bidoff, who I know is known around the world and a dear, wise soul on this topic. Maggie Dent's done some amazing work around this topic as well with boys. And I know all our heads and hearts are here as well. I have two boys, and so it's a conversation piece in our home a lot. But I would hate to see our boys lose their way in their identity. And I don't want to see that for boys. And I don't want to see it for our girls either. And I want them to all grow up knowing that they can be themselves and have a seen place in the world. But I do feel like our boys have a vulnerability there that's been very much misunderstood, and they can get labelled very quickly and very easy in the area of their sexuality, and I think it's very unfair. There's a lot of incredibly kind, generous boys, and there's a very small percent of boys in our high schools that sometimes are a loud minority that are intentional about taking advantage of our girls.
Coming back to like the role of us as parents, what's the role of the father with young boys, with tween boys, and what's the role of the mom and like vice versa with the girls? Is there something different that we have to give?
The role is what is negotiated in homes these days. I mean, we don't have these set guidelines like we used to have. The research, I think, around this is really fascinating. A mother's role is still so critical in a child's life, and that has never changed. And a dad gets less dopamine hits from hugs and cuddles and that nurturing space than a mother does, but he is more likely to champion risks and autonomy than a mother will. And I don't know, in my life, I have been fortunate enough to have both roles in my life, both people in my life. My father is incredibly nurturing, which is a really interesting role, but he definitely has championed the risk-taking side of me. I think in our home, my husband has definitely championed the autonomy and risk-taking side of my boys as well. I've worked and I've played, you know, an interesting role in my boys' life, and career-wise, I've really championed them. So I guess to your point, Andrea, I don't think there's any black and whites with what's in a child's life, but it only takes one caring, trusted adult who's consistently in a child's life, and they don't even have to be there long term, but the resilient kids are the ones that know how to access those trusted adults in every season of their life. And those trusted adults are ones that can love them unconditionally, who can hold them to their potential And who can model a really good skill set for those kids? And when kids are lucky enough for them to be biological and they're lucky enough to have two parents in their life, or have a male and female in their life that are able to bring slightly different perspectives, I think that's just wonderful for children.
Mm-hmm. Bringing up trust, there was something that you mentioned. You called it a trust room, where you wanted to take your kids to and where you can share things. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Look, I think everyone, you know, like you have these spaces and places where you go to talk about stuff with your kids. And for us, we've had spaces and places. When my kids were teenagers, sometimes it was like we're going for a drive. And, you know, it was like, I'm locking the doors. This might take a while. You know, like we've got some stuff you and I need to talk about. And side by side, not direct eyeballing them, but like we need to talk, you know, we need a cone of silence. We need to know that it's just you and me, and the car was the place, and I don't care where we're driving, but it's here. Back deck, their bedroom. I think they need autonomy and choice in that. And they also need to know the time limit that you're going to shut up by. So okay. I've often said to my kids, this is going to take about 20 minutes. You know, like I would think we're going to go on for hours and they might opt out.
Okay. But so that was something that you created and then you kind of like pulled your kid into the trust room, not the other way around. Or could it be both ways?
It can be both ways. Yeah.
Okay.
Both ways. And I think it always needs to be both ways. Another thing that I've done too is I've given families like a buzzer to take home if things are getting really heated all the time and they're having trouble with emotional regulation. And sometimes I get questions from families that like, I've got ADHD, my child's got ADHD. It's really hard for us to regulate this house. And I've said, look, take this little buzzer home, put it on the kitchen table. And if things are getting heated and your child is feeling like it's getting out of hand, or you feel like it is, and everyone wants to take five, press the button. It's the same concept. And I feel like when respect goes two ways with your children, they're much more likely to feel like it's, number one, fair, that they get a say, and that we're also leading them into this place where they're able to use this complex thinking. You know, they're able to start to use that autonomy a little bit more. They're able to think for themselves. They're able to have a say in our homes, use their voice. And that's so positive.
Mm-hmm. I love the concept of the buzzer, but what happens if it's hit? What happens right afterwards? Everybody just is quiet and takes 5 minutes of a break, or what happens?
Yeah, that's the idea. Yeah, 5 to 20 minutes sometimes takes a little bit longer for everyone to sort of regulate and calm down, and then we come back. The idea is that we don't just break and then no one comes back to it, but everyone just takes a minute if there's discomfort and everyone's feeling like it's too much for them and it's not helpful.
Okay, I love this. And I will absolutely try this.
I think the point is it's saying, hey, I trust you to have a voice. And it's giving them that kind of grown-up power, not just to do a chore, but to actually have an opinion that matters. And at this age, this 9 to 12 age, like, doesn't that feel grown-up for them? Like, that actually feels like you're taking me seriously. Because kids go, you're still treating me like a baby and I'm not a baby anymore. And they're right. Like, they're not. But they're not quite there to like have the reins of some of the things that they want to, you know, and they want to be teenagers already and they're not. We need in-between solutions for this age. And, yeah, I found the trust room, the buzzer on the bench. There's these little in-between solutions that help them feel grown up.
It's a big issue at our house right now. I love that you're taking this up. I have an 8-year-old, an 11-year-old, and a 13-year-old. And autonomy is a big issue. And I think what sometimes, like if you have more than one child, what's also happening in a family like ours is that there's so many things that need to be taken into consideration and nobody always wants the same thing. So somebody always has to, you know, just go along with it. But for them to understand that for us as parents, it's really difficult to manage everybody's expectations and then, you know, life also. And I think yeah, explaining that to them is a difficult endeavor.
And Andrea, if you and I hear the frustration, like I can hear how complicated that is, and I can hear it. You're like, I'm trying, and they don't like it. But yeah. This is the greatest, most important lesson that they can learn. Like, life just isn't fair. You can't cut a cake in four pieces easily. It's much more easy to cut it fairly in two. But, you know, life's not like that. You're dealing with multiple people, multiple needs. The moment they go into a job, they're going to have lots of complexities with different needs and people. And I've been really honest with my kids about that. You're two different people. You've got two different needs. You've got two different natures. This is not always going to look fair on a transactional level. But what is fair is that I love you both 100% equally. And I will show up for you with 100% of my heart every time you need me. And that's the fairness you can expect from me.
Yeah. I want to go a little bit deeper, like talk to you about our role as in, if these years are so important, you said, you know, kids are particularly moldable in these years. It's like the biggest time of development. They're learning so much. You also said that there are windows of opportunity and that they're learning so much in this time. It's like gusts of wind where they're just like taking in all this learning. So yeah. For me, it's funny because that's how it's been feeling like for me, that I'm much more needed than maybe even when they were younger. I feel like I have to be here more. I have to realize or even like listen in on the small things and get in there in the right moment, which takes a lot of time. And so I'm kind of wondering, like, from your perspective, are these the years that we should, you know, expect to put in more time? Because I feel like it's also it's the same time where a lot of people or a lot of women, especially, they like want to focus more on their careers, and they feel like, you know, I'm finally there in school and I'm getting back into my work life. But I have to say, I find it very difficult.
Every child's going to be needing something different, but this is what I'm hearing from a lot of parents. And parents are saying to me, I'm going to cut down on work part-time because I can see that they really need me right now. This is what I'm hearing. And this intuition that you've got that's saying this is actually really important is research-based, accurate. Think of them like a tree that's blooming in spring. Their brain is just growing expansively right now. And in the teenage years, it's going to get pruned back and they're going to individualize and become their own person. But right now they're growing towards the light, and the light is you. And the more attention and the more time that you can give them, the better, because they're going to grow towards your values, towards that moral compass that you've got. Most parents that are listening in know that the more that you will be around, the more your child will suck up your attention right now. Come 14, 15, that's not going to happen anymore. You are going to be their taxi driver and they are going to have their schedule and life. And right now you've got this incredible opportunity to invest in them and to lay this platform of trust that will never leave your kids. Not one ounce of it will ever be lost. And they will be able to come back to that trust room. They will be able to come back to every strategy you've been able to invest into their life right now.
So is that something that people should actually kind of plan into their life plan and haven't done so far, maybe?
I like that idea. And I like that idea. I can't tell people. Everyone's in a different financial position for different reasons. And I'll be talking to some parents who are single parents here that are like, I've got to work and I've got to work full time.
Of course.
But make the time you have with your kids count, because they need you.
Mm-hmm. And there's one last thing that I wanted to ask you about, because I didn't really know what it meant and I didn't really know what to make of it. You said connection over comfort. And I think that's aimed at me as a parent, right? So it's like my comfort that kind of needs to be pushed to the side, and I have to like prioritize a connection with my kid.
Yeah. And I think they get to an age where they're quite easy and we manage our life and they revolve around us a little bit for a while. And then all of a sudden they start getting kind of intrusive on our time and they start interrupting us, and it does inconvenience us and it pushes our comfort out of the way. And even things like dropping down to part-time work, needing us at night, wanting to cry on our shoulders for hours about something that we think is completely ridiculous. This is connection over comfort. One mom said to me, she wants to make cupcakes at 9 o'clock at night and kitchen is closed at 7:30. And I looked at her and went, welcome, welcome to the years where they need a bit more autonomy, mum, you know. Or she wants to do rugby. Like, I've said no to rugby for years. And I'm like, you know, maybe consideration of what she wants as she's getting older. You know, it's connection over our comfort, even our comfort of risk of all sorts of things. So thank you for bringing that one up, Andrea. That's a big one, especially as they go into the teenage years.
We are almost at the end of our time together. So I'm just going to ask you, is there anything else that we didn't touch on where you think that my Swiss audience definitely needs to know about tweens and how to live with them?
Oh, I think thank you to the Swiss audience for having me. I would like to say, if there's anything that you feel like is like debris in the runway between you and your tween's relationship, clear it now. So it's time to clear the runway between your heart and your child's heart now. So it's not there when they hit the teenage years. So fill their love tank up, clear any debris, and make sure the connection is really strong now. So when those teenage years come, you've got this bond that's really solid. And as they start to push and move into the world, they know that you're there for them and you're their number one.
Thank you so much for taking the time and giving us all this advice.
My absolute pleasure. I'm just thrilled to be with you.
Yeah, same for me. Thank you so much, Michelle.
Thank you.
Mal ehrlich, hören magst du jetzt auch nicht mehr. Aber vielleicht magst du noch lesen oder schauen. Du findest uns auch unter mal-ehrlich.ch oder in den sozialen Medien. Merci fürs Zuhören.